This BBC podcast is supported by ads outside the UK.
The world is on the brink. Wars, contentious elections, disinformation spreading at warp speed, and Donald Trump at the center of all of it. But what does it mean for the rest of us? Every week on Pod Save the World, Tommy Vietor and I cut through the noise to explain how global power is shifting. No jargon, no homework, just clear, honest conversations about what's happening and why it matters. From breaking news to long simmering international conflicts, we dissect it all with critical analysis and some jokes that will surely embarrass our children one day. Tune in to Pod Save the World every Wednesday, wherever you get your podcasts, or catch it on YouTube.
Welcome to Lady Killers with me, Lucy Worsley, where true crime meets history with a twist from BBC Radio 4.
Murder, £100 reward. Whereas on Tuesday, the second day of October last, one Thomas Higgins died at number 27 Ascot Street in the city of Liverpool. And it has since been discovered that the death of the said Thomas Higgins was caused by arsenic poisoning. Notice is hereby given that a reward of £100 will be paid to any person who shall give such information as shall lead to the conviction of the murderer or murderers.
This is Lady Killers, the series where ordinary women act in extraordinary ways. We're examining the wild and unthinkable crimes from history, supposedly committed by different murderesses from Britain, North America, and Australia, and we're looking at them afresh through the eyes of modern-day feminists. Transport yourself back to the parts of 1880s Liverpool where the lowest-paid workers live. Life is tough. Accommodation is overcrowded. More people are cramming themselves into the city every day in the hope of finding a better life. It seems there's no way out of poverty unless you discover a lucrative business idea. But how far would you go to make money? Our guest detective for this case is the legendary crime writer Linda LaPlante, CBE. She's the author of the celebrated book series Widows and Trial and Retribution. She's created the award-winning TV shows Prime Suspect and The Governor. And she's now the co-host of a forensic science podcast series called Listening to the Dead. And of course, Linda was born and raised in Liverpool. Welcome, Linda.
Oh, thank you very much.
And also joining us is our resident historian, Professor Rosalind Crone from the Open University. Welcome, Roz.
Hello, Lucy. Hello, Linda.
Hello.
Liverpool, 1883. It's a city by the sea in northwest England. It's a city of industry as well as a port, with a large community of Irish immigrants, many of whom came here to try to escape the Irish famine of the 1840s, sometimes called the Great Famine or the Great Hunger. And now the city has seen the mysterious death of Thomas Higgins. Who exactly was he? Thomas was the husband of Margaret, an Irish incomer, who lives in Liverpool near to her widowed sister Catherine Flanagan and her lodgers. Money is tight and life is hard. And to understand more of what life would have been like for Catherine and Margaret, our Liverpudlian sisters, Roz has gone to meet Liz Stewart, the curator of archaeology and historic environments at the Museum of Liverpool, in a reconstructed housing court.
This is an example of a 19th century type of housing which was very common in Liverpool, where small houses were tucked in behind the main streets. A very standard layout is what we have here, which is where we go through an arched entrance, and then the courtyard opens out into something about 3 or 4 metres wide, with houses on both sides. The courts were often kind of interlinked routes behind the street fronts. They're a warren that are sort of semi-private, and only the people who live there really know their way around.
So could you describe for me the type of people who would have lived in these houses?
These were some of the cheaper houses to rent in Liverpool, but the other kind of crucial factor was that there were a lot of this type of housing nearer the docks in the area around Scotland Road.
That's actually where the people in the case that we're looking at lived, in, I think, housing like this. I have managed to discover them in the census for 1861. Now, we've plotted them out on a map. Catherine and her husband John were then living at 142 Blenheim Street, which is around about here. The 1871 census has them down here in Tenterden Street, and then they move back to Blenheim Street, and they kind of jump around the place a bit. And then eventually the household divides, mm-hmm. and Catherine's sister goes to live in a cellar in Ascot Street. These copies of the census, they also reveal quite interesting details about the family. In 1861, for example, we have Catherine Flanagan with her husband John, and Catherine is described as a beer housekeeper. In 1881, Catherine is now a widow. We have all these people who are listed as boarders. So she's also taking in lodgers at the same time. And she's described as a licensed broker. Now, a broker suggests to me someone selling insurance for people in the neighbourhood, people she lives with, etc.
And you do get to people who sort of take these roles within the neighbourhood and be those sort of community organisers.
She's quite entrepreneurial, isn't she?
She certainly seems so. And I think a lot of women in this period kind of needed to be, particularly if they're left on their own as a widow, as she was.
Catherine and Margaret move around quite a lot then, if mostly within the same neighbourhood, this Irish working class community. And Catherine has a whole lot of different lodgers coming and going, some of them moving on to other addresses, two of them actually dying on the premises. But these deaths don't arouse suspicion. This is the harsh reality of Victorian poverty and of living in these crowded and unhygienic conditions. One way of protecting yourself from the close reality of death is to take out life insurance. Actually, Thomas Higgins had several policies in his name. After his death, his widow Margaret and her sister, that life insurance broker Catherine, begin to collect the money due. The policies were actually worth more than £100. That's quite a lot of money, isn't it, Linda?
It's a huge amount of money then. But even now, £100, you're looking at £15,000 in today's money.
That's a life-changing amount of money, isn't it, in 1880s Liverpool?
Life-changing. You could buy a house for £500.
Linda, I understand that you're from the posh part of Liverpool. Is that fair to say?
Oh, yeah, that's right, yeah. I am, but Liverpool is a very strange, extraordinary place to live because there are so many different worlds there and different parts of it.
When you were growing up there, did you have experience of people who were living in difficult conditions, in poverty?
No, not at all. But one was always aware that inside Liverpool City, there were still the low areas. But because in the last war, Liverpool was bombarded because they were going for the docks. The outcome of that was a lot of poverty there. But before that, during this period we're talking about, it was a hive of activity. The docks were flourishing. So were the slums.
What a city. Now, Roz, Catherine is a life insurance broker. What does that mean?
In the 19th century, life insurance became very popular among the working classes because working class life was full of risk. Risk at work, risk at home, unhygienic conditions that people lived in. You wanted life insurance for the breadwinner of the family in order to have money if it was taken away prematurely. Now, the industry, as it expanded into the working classes, became quite unscrupulous and quite dodgy. And this was because the agents who were there going around setting up policies among the working classes, they earned their commission off the back of the policies they were able to negotiate. I think Catherine's role in all of this was connecting agents with possible policy holders. So she sat between the agent and the person whose life was insured. Now, she was playing a bit of a dangerous game. Often the person whose life was insured didn't actually know that. And she set herself up, or her sister up, or someone else up as the beneficiary of that person's death.
When you're writing a criminal character, Linda, how much of their criminality do you root in, you know, their personal character, and how much in their background, the world in which they're living?
I have to dig deep. So in this instance, like Catherine, if you dig into her character, you have to first off kind of remove the horror. And just say, OK, here we have this very larger-than-life character. The slums, they had no running water, their houses were cramped, but they integrated in and out of each other's houses. So Catherine was illiterate. However, she was handling all these insurance contracts. She was capable of handling not one, not two, not three, four, five, maybe 10 different insurance payouts. She must have had like a calculator in her head.
So you make Catherine, you've made me realise her achievement, really. Do you think under other circumstances and given an education, she could have been a CEO or a captain of industry?
Oh, definitely. Yes, she could have been an entrepreneur. How do you handle 6 different contracts for people's life insurance? You know, he's got £1.10 there, we've got 17 shillings, that one. And yet still she was able to calculate and remember, but also you've got to keep an understanding of how much the money was worth in those days. And she was making a fortune.
Now, Thomas Higgins had been a hod carrier. That means his job was bringing materials to bricklayers. And he'd been apparently healthy and certainly physically active. His death came as a shock to his brother Patrick. Learning about the insurance policies, Patrick becomes suspicious. He goes to see a doctor with his concerns. They both visit the coroner. Then they set off to Margaret's house to see the body. But this turns out to be a race against time.
We rush to Ascot Street, where the body of my brother lies. When we arrive, it's the wake. A hearse is outside. Thomas's body is in the coffin, ready to be taken away. The funeral stops. I'm so glad we got here, just in time. The doctor and coroner start conducting a post-mortem on Thomas's body and store some of his stomach and intestines for chemical testing later. But upon seeing us and the policemen, Catherine Flanagan flees.
Catherine disappears, melting into the streets of Liverpool, leaving Margaret behind to get arrested. Linda, what do you think when somebody flees an investigation like that? It doesn't look good, does it? Although I suppose people might panic.
They might panic, but you're looking at a society that has no particular news coverage. I mean, the news would go from door to door and somebody would talk in the pub and say they're looking for her, you know. Are they? What for? So that was slow progress. She was hidden very well by neighbours and people surrounding the same area. So she was moving around, but it's still relevant today. I mean, if you think the horror and tragedy that happened recently in Liverpool when their little girl was shot, they've asked for witnesses to come forward. Where are they? Somebody's hiding them. So it is still something that tragically goes on today.
You're referring there, Linda, to the case of Olivia Pratt Corbell, a little 9-year-old girl shot dead in her own home recently in Liverpool. This happened because of something to do with criminal gangs. And we've been hearing on the news that the community, the criminal gang community, have not been cooperating with the investigation and have been slow to come forward with evidence. This sounds rather familiar, doesn't it, Roz?
Yes, it does. It's this kind of idea of snitches get stitches. And that's why I think Patrick Higgins, in this case, the brother of Thomas, was actually really brave to raise his suspicions and to carry this forward.
So people in these cases are weighing up the risks of helping the police and the possible retribution from their own community if they do.
That's exactly right.
Do you think that this is the tipping point for the sisters, Linda? If Thomas Higgins's brother hadn't been so suspicious, they'd have just gone on and on, wouldn't they?
Oh, yes, definitely. I mean, Patrick said, you know, hang on a second here. You know, he was very fit. He was lifting bricks the other week.
Yeah.
And you're telling me now he's dead? What, with bronchitis? No, rubbish. And it's that kind of attitude that if he hadn't demanded it, which then made the insurance man go and go, well, that's not the man I remember meeting to insure. It's simple as that, you know. It was just one hiccup.
So Catherine is now on the run, this powerful, scary woman. And Roz has been reconstructing the quite extensive route she now takes around Liverpool to avoid the police. What have you discovered, Roz?
I've reconstructed the route using witness testimony.
So this red line on the map, that's her route across the city.
Where she goes. Where she's going.
So it's fabulous.
So when she leaves the Higgins cellar here, she quickly runs back to her own house and grabs some belongings. Then she goes to Rockingham Street, where her friends the Mackenzies live, and she stays with them for 3 nights. During that time, they run some errands for her, bring her tidbits of information, and she gives them some money. Now, after 3 nights, she decides she needs to leave. Things are getting a bit sticky in the neighbourhood, and she ends up in lodgings in Lydia Ann Street, another Irish neighbourhood.
Was she walking or was she on a tram or...
Taxi.
Taxi!
Of course, because she's got money to spend. Now, she only stays there for 1 night because, again, things get very sticky and she has to move. She's on the run again. She heads east and finds lodgings at a house in Mount St Vernon Street run by a Mrs Booth. But after five nights, it's clear that she's got to move on again. Mr. Booth has been taking a keen interest in the poisoning case and reading aloud little snippets from the newspaper. Catherine then heads for Edge Hill train station. She makes it as far as Wavertree Road, where she asks for directions. And Mrs. Ward kindly agrees to show her the way. It's interesting, the newspapers at the time actually think even on the 15th of October, when she's over there heading for the train station, they still think she's in that Scotland Road neighbourhood hiding out. And they talk about how impenetrable those streets are.
Gosh, fabulous.
While Catherine's on the run, it's confirmed from the post-mortem and from chemical analysis of samples from the body that Thomas Higgins was poisoned. Ros, how would they have gained access to the poison used?
Well, that's a really good question, because the sale of pure arsenic had become regulated over the course of the 19th century in response to cases of poisoning. However, it was still used in pest control. And in this case, they went down to the shop and they bought flypaper, which contained arsenic, brought it home and soaked the arsenic out of the flypaper into little bottles that they could then use in tea, in food, to poison their victims.
Gosh. What do you think about the dynamic between the two sisters, Linda? Obviously, Catherine's gone on the run, leaving her sister Margaret to get arrested and to take the rap. What do you think about that?
I think she manipulated her sister. Mm. You know, you can manipulate somebody to help you in this crime, but at the same time, the other person, her sister, also has to witness what they're doing. So you can't just remove the blame.
9 days after her escape, Catherine has worked her way over to the eastern side of the city, to Edge Hill Railway Station, which Ros went to explore.
The next train to arrive at...
Apart from the overhead power lines above me here and diesel and electric engines going past and the occasional tannoy announcement, it's not so different from the station that Catherine would have known. The train is Catherine's last chance of freedom. If she manages to leave Liverpool, it is highly likely that she will never be caught. She can easily change her name and reinvent herself. However, Catherine misses her train. And it's at this point that everything starts to unravel. Catherine decides to wait for the next train. She and Mrs. Ward go to the Tunnel Hotel. It's now demolished, but the hotel was situated just up the top there, sitting above the Lime Street Tunnel. They are joined by another young man, and Catherine buys them all drinks. She talks about a warrant being out against her for selling her son's furniture. She's obviously flush with cash, and those around her start getting a bit suspicious. Word reaches Inspector Keeley at the police office in Wavertree. He decides to go to the hotel. When he gets there, he's told that they have gone to 35 Ono Street. He follows them there, and he finds Catherine having dinner before the next train. He recognises her from the handbill describing the wanted woman for the Higgins murder that he happens to have in his pocket. And he arrests her.
So, after 10 days on the run, Catherine gets captured. She'd made the mistake of missing that train and of flashing too much cash. She joins her sister Margaret under arrest. And now evidence comes out from those other mysterious deaths under Catherine's roof. Other bodies are exhumed. And between them, Catherine and Margaret are now charged with four murders, starting with that of Margaret's husband, Thomas Higgins. So, Linda, how do you feel about the way that Catherine was captured? It couldn't have been more dramatic, really. She so nearly got away.
It was a classic. If she'd got on the train, that was it. They doubted that they would have ever found her. But in reality, I think she would have always come back.
She would have come back, do you think?
Always, always. She's
why?
Like a homing pigeon. Out of that security of that area she knew, she would have to make a completely new life. I don't think she would be able to do that as easily as she would be able to come back. I don't think she ever thought she would be on trial the way she was.
Well, it's challenging for anybody to be on trial, but somebody who's controlled everything, all these people for so long. Gosh, what a humiliation. Ros, what do we know about the trial?
The trial was held at St George's Hall in Liverpool, and it only took 3 days, which seems really, really short in the present day, doesn't it? Now, what's really interesting, though, is how the newspapers reported that trial. There were three daily newspapers at the time, Liverpool Mercury, Liverpool Daily Post, and Liverpool Echo. Now, according to the Echo, there wasn't that much interest in the trial to start with. The crowd wasn't as big as expected outside. Now, the other two newspapers made a big deal. They said, no, there were big crowds, they're hammering to get in. All three newspapers, though, said there were way more women in the gallery than men.
I think the women were all there because, like me, they were fascinated by the idea of a bad woman.
Or they were slightly worried that they'd had a couple of life insurance policies out. You never know.
The jury deliberate for nearly an hour, and then the verdict is revealed.
Catherine Flanagan and Margaret Higgins, you have been found guilty of the crime of willful murder. Considering the relationship of the murdered man, Thomas Higgins, to you, to say nothing of others in whose death it is suggested you have been implicated, the murder is a crime so horrible, carried out so cruelly, from motives so morbid, that it makes one shudder to think to what depths humanity is capable of sinking. For the crime you have committed, you must die.
Both sisters are found guilty and sentenced to hang, which means they don't actually get tried for the other three crimes. And once the trial is over, Catherine makes a confession. She hopes that this might mean she avoids the gallows.
I admit that I had knowledge of poison being administered to the persons whose death I am now charged with causing. But I deny that I administered it myself. The person who is responsible for the inception of the crime is Margaret Evans, an Irish woman living in Blenheim Street. My sister, Margaret Higgins, then lived with Evans, and she has since told me that she and Evans poisoned another girl and that Evans obtained the poison. I never at any time gave poison to Thomas Higgins, although I knew well what was going on. All the insurances on his life, made by me, were made at the request of his wife. My sister instigated the murders and attended upon the victims in each instance.
So Catherine is now saying that she only sorted the insurance and she didn't take part in the actual killings. But she is making it sound like she and her sister were part of a kind of criminal girl gang with other women being involved. In fact, in the whole of the rest of the statement, she also name checks several other women. So, Linda, is this a case of a gang of women murdering people for life insurance?
I mean, I don't think you could call them a gang. They lived in the peripheral of each other. And this was something so simple to get money, to be able to live. But you see, Catherine's confession. If one is to believe that this is an illiterate woman, she's saying things like poison administered to the person. Would she use the word administer? You know, they had to sit and have their statements taken by a clerk of the court or a lawyer, and they would rewrite them.
You think the confession's been kind of tidied up and mediated
totally
through the pen of a man?
By some administrator.
Ros, she's naming all of these other women, and we don't think that the police follow this up, do we? Why not?
The statement is made before the trial to the solicitor, so he's the one taking it down. It's lodged after the conviction, and it's Catherine's chance of getting out of hanging. The authorities do take it seriously, and there's correspondence that goes on between them, the DPP and the prosecuting solicitor, wondering how they should deal with this thing. They decide not to because Catherine still places herself pretty much at the heart of all these stories. So there's not enough evidence to say that it's these other women doing the poisoning. So do we have a conspiracy, a poisoning syndicate, or is this a case of Catherine clutching at straws? That's the big question here. So I think we have to be a little bit suspicious of the idea of a poisoning syndicate or some kind of conspiracy.
Linda, clearly we think the motive here is money. That's a good, long-standing, pretty perpetual motive for crime, isn't it?
One of the biggest. There's the heart, love and treason, all that. But money lurks at the end of most crimes. And sadly, we live in a world where there's a lot of poverty. Money is always hanging over everybody. And, you know, criminality, it draws people in. I think today it's hard to believe that insurance fraud is one of the main crimes in America for murder.
Still. Gosh.
And, for example, a few years ago, he was a firefighter, very handsome, strong, married to a very young, attractive woman, and he died of a heart attack. And his widow was therefore able to claim not only his pension, but around $50,000. Then about 18 months later, the widow remarried, this time a police officer. And he was very fit, very handsome. It was a wonderful marriage. And he died of a heart attack. And by this time, the widow had moved to a different area. But the mother of the firefighter saw a photograph and said, "This is suspicious because my son died in exactly the same manner. Police should look into this," which they subsequently did. And it was murder. And she was using antifreeze. And antifreeze is sweet. And so people were drinking this quite happily, unaware it's poison.
I knew it was poisonous. I didn't realize it was also tasty.
Yes. Gosh. Well, now it is no longer tasty. They have altered it. But it was proved that she did two murders for insurance and pensions. And that is just one of hundreds and hundreds of cases that are ongoing.
Linda, Catherine and Margaret become known as the Black Widows. And you've written a whole series called Widows. Why are we so drawn to female criminals?
Because I think it's unusual. And I think because in the period we're talking about, death came round every single day. But the difference was that they were hastening it on. And I think the fact that sometimes you can actually say to somebody, "What did Ruth Ellis look like?" And they may never have been even born at that time. And they can describe Ruth Ellis's face.
There's a glamour, isn't there?
Yes, and Myra Hindley. There's a look. Rose West. People can picture her because there is something so evil in an evil woman that in a way transcends a male killer.
Mm.
You know, I don't think you can see in a Ted Bundy the evil you could see in the eyes of Myra Hindley.
And that's just because we don't expect women to be evil, isn't it? We're not supposed to do bad things, are we, us ladies?
Yeah. But I think we can understand, you know, emotional murders, that romantic, you know, love torn. One can somehow face that. It's cold-blooded murder that is very difficult to understand.
And this is a cold crime, isn't it?
Terrible.
The sisters are executed on the 4th of March, 1884, in Kirkdale Prison. But their infamy continues today. It is impossible to feel any real sympathy for them. They killed people for the life insurance money. But you know, some of the things the sisters do, working together as a team, trusting other women, trying to climb out of poverty, well, you know, I get that. And the reason that these two have a horrible glamour, I think it lies in their nickname, doesn't it? The Black Widows. Two of them. One murderess on her own is terrifying enough. But two women, two widows, out of the control of men. That is truly horrible. The reason we're still talking about these two today is that deeply troubling idea of feminine conspiracy. Thank you to our guest detective, Linda LaPlante, CBE, and of course, to Professor Rosalind Crone. Next time on Lady Killers, we're heading across the Atlantic to North America, to Boston, Massachusetts, to meet a nurse who you wouldn't want looking after you. Lady Killers with Lucy Worsley is produced by Hannah Fisher, and the readers are Jonathan Keeble and Claire Corbett. Sound design is by Chris McLean, and the series producer is Julia Habel. It's a Story Hunter production from BBC Radio 4.
The world is on the brink. Wars, contentious elections, disinformation spreading at warp speed, and Donald Trump at the center of all of it. But what does it mean for the rest of us? Every week on Pod Save the World, Tommy Vietor and I cut through the noise to explain how global power is shifting. No jargon, no homework, just clear, honest conversations about what's happening and why it matters. From breaking news to long simmering international conflicts, we dissect it all with critical analysis and some jokes that will surely embarrass our children one day. Tune in to Pod Save the World every Wednesday, wherever you get your podcasts, or catch it on YouTube.